You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this micro-learning podcast, a new era in geographic atrophy, addressing the complement system and improving patient outcomes. In this episode, we discuss the role of ophthalmologists and retina specialists in diagnosing and treating geographic atrophy, or GA. My name is Caitlin Rothermel, and I'm pleased to be your host today. I'm joined by Dr. Tavish Nanda, a board-certified ophthalmologist and vitreoretinal specialist based in Hartford, Connecticut. Dr. Nanda practices at Retina Consultants PC and has contributed extensively to the field with over 50 publications and presentations at national and international meetings. Dr. Nanda has also served as a sub-investigator in more than 24 clinical trials. How are you doing today, Dr. Nanda?
Great. Thank you, Caitlin, for having me. Excited to be here.
Oh, I'm really glad that you joined us. Why don't we start with a brief overview of what geographic atrophy is? Who's at risk for it and how is it diagnosed?
Yeah, so geographic atrophy is essentially the advanced stage of dry, age-related macular degeneration. And as the name implies, it tends to be something that starts in people's 60s, for example, usually asymptomatic. You know, they get a little bit of some changes in the back of the eyes, difficulty with focusing, things of that nature. And as the disease progresses, usually over many years to sometimes decades, the areas that are affected start to atrophy. And you get basically what we call geographic atrophy, which are these patches. They look like continents on a map. That's what we call it, geographic atrophy. And these areas basically are places in someone's central vision where they no longer can see. We call those scotomas. And so anyone who really has dry age-related macular degeneration is at risk for it over time. The rate at which people reach geographic atrophy varies, and it's usually diagnosed by their ophthalmologist or retina specialist who they are hopefully plugged in with, you know, once they've been diagnosed.
For the specialists who are taking care of the diagnosis, what sort of instrumentation or imaging procedures would they be most likely using to observe this?
Yeah, so we use basically two main modalities. One is photography, specifically what's called fundus autofluorescence, which is kind of a black and white photo that really highlights the areas of atrophy for us. And the other is what's called an optical coherence tomography, or OCT, which is basically like our MRI of the retina. And that can pick up geographic atrophy at an earlier stage or an incomplete stage prior to it becoming more atrophic.
Terrific. And let's talk a little bit about the new treatments that have been approved fairly recently for geographic atrophy. What are these treatments and what are the clinical data showing in terms of benefits and safety?
Yeah, so an exciting time certainly is a new era that is not superfluous. Prior to the development of these medications, we had no way really of treating geographic atrophy except, screening patients every 6 months and kind of informing them that their vision is going to get worse. And so since 2023, there have been two medications that have been approved. One is Avacincaptad Pegol, or ACP for short, and the other one is Pegcetacoplan. Pegcetacoplan was a little bit earlier in 2023, and I believe ACP was just shortly after that. And so two different medications, they both target what's called the complement system. And so they treat kind of the inflammatory process that causes progression in macular degeneration. And they're usually given either monthly or every other month, kind of long term. They're a chronic therapy. And the clinical data is pretty exciting. You know, for the first time ever, we've been able to show a slowing of geographic atrophy lesion size with both of these medications. We do have some long-term data for both of them. They've been out now for several years in the real world. And based off of that data, we can accurately tell patients that they are going to see a slowing of geographic atrophy growth by anywhere from the high teens to even the low 30s in percent terms, depending on the type of atrophy they have, you know, if it's involving the center of vision or not. And so the benefits we're seeing is essentially buying people more time than they would otherwise to do the things that they love, reading, driving, you know, walking around, things of that nature.
Right. And let's focus in on the treatment safety. With these therapies being so new, I imagine clinicians and patients are still getting comfortable with how to weigh the risks and benefits of choosing this treatment. What do we know so far about the safety profiles?
So these medications are given as most intravitreal medications are given. You know, it's an injection into the eye. And so we have a lot of history of doing that with wet macular degeneration or exudative macular degeneration. And so from that perspective, the safety profile kind of mirrors what you would expect for an intravitreal injection process. So something like endophthalmitis, which is an increased risk for an infection in the eye, is about the same, you know, that you would expect. That being said, there are a few other notable risks that I think are important to discuss with patients. Number one, anyone can be allergic to anything, right? And these are new medications. And so when you trial a medication like this in the eye, there's always the risk for an inflammatory reaction, what we call uveitis. And we have seen that even with the medications used for exudative macular degeneration, but of course is something we do discuss in our patients who are undergoing complement inhibitor therapy specifically, because complement inhibitor therapy is calming down kind of an immune process, right? So it is important to mention that. Other than that, the other two main risks that I specifically like to discuss with my patients is one, the risk for retinal vasculitis. Retinal vasculitis can be a very devastating condition in the back of the eyes if it does happen. The risk for that is exceedingly small and usually highest after the first injection. The vast majority of cases, if not the most, I think most cases, if not all of them, have been with pegcetacoplan. I do not believe there are any published cases yet with ACP. That being said, the risk is extremely low. I believe the rate is about 0.01%. There have been about 20 cases and over 500,000 injections of pegcetacoplan given out. And about 50% of those patients who had vasculitis did have reasonably good visual recovery. The other 50% did not, unfortunately. And so when I talk about these medications with my patients, you know, I usually tell them I'm going to trial the medication on one eye first, usually the worse eye, just to make sure they get through the first one or two injections with no problem. And I do that for both pegcetacoplan and ACP because both do function in a similar capacity. The last risk that I do like to talk about is the slight increase for exudative or wet macular degeneration with these medications. And so a lot of patients who I'm treating already have exudative macular degeneration and they have geographic atrophy in addition. And so for them, that's really not a discussion, so to speak. But for those who do not, there is an increased chance. So if they have, for example, about a 6% risk per year of converting to wet macular degeneration with these medications, you might say, hey, you know, that's going to increase up to 9 to 12%, for example. It's a risk, but it is also not something that is a contraindication, you know, in my opinion. And why is that? Because our treatments for exudative AMD are very good. And usually, because I am seeing these patients so often for their dry GA treatment, I'm able to catch these conversions very early, usually earlier than we would normally. And so if anything, it's kind of a silver lining that I'm catching exudative disease at such an early stage that they don't even know it's there. And we can get on top of it at an earlier time point.
That sounds excellent, right? So let's focus in on patient selection now, because from what I understand, there's a lot of nuance involved in determining which patients are good candidates for treatment for their GA, and also some degree of expectations management that you need to engage in with patients and their families. What are some of these key factors to consider when deciding who to treat, who's the best candidate for treatment?
Yeah, so I think this is a little bit challenging because there is a fundamental difference between who's a good candidate or an ideal candidate and sometimes a motivated candidate, right? And both of those don't always align. So who would be the ideal or good candidate, kind of the patient who I think would be motivated but also a very good candidate would be someone who has significant geographic atrophy that's taken out the center of their vision in one eye. So they already know what it does and where their vision will go if they're untreated, but has asymmetric disease, meaning the contralateral eye still has good vision or reasonably good vision. And so that's a patient who's an exceptional candidate because you want to provide them as much time as you can because they're essentially and functionally monocular. And they're motivated too because they believe you. They understand what's going to happen to their good eye. It's going to become like their bad eye over time. So that's one where both things kind of align. Now, of course, there are good candidates who may not be so motivated. So who is a good candidate that wouldn't be motivated? That would be someone who has very good vision in both eyes. Maybe they're 20/20 or 20/30, but you see that they have atrophy, kind of what we call non-foveally, meaning not in the center of their vision. And it's hard to tell a patient that, hey, you know, I know you're seeing so well, but I want to do this invasive procedure every 2 months on you for the rest of your life to try and keep you that way as best as I can. And they'll say, well, on a day-to-day basis, I walk around, you know, no problem. It's hard to tell them that, you know, in a year or two, that this is going to change. Most patients want to see a change visually before they pursue therapy. But in my opinion, those are the best candidates because that's what the data shows. The clinical trial data shows that non-subfoveal patients, so patients who have reasonably good vision, tend to benefit the most from these injections. Upwards of 30%+ slowing of geographic atrophy lesion size 4 years out from treatment. And so those are pen candidates that I would love to be motivated, but it's a challenging discussion. And then of course there are patients who are motivated who have family members who had reduced vision over time. And so those patients, because they have strong family history, would be good candidates because they also know where this is going and they've seen a world where treatment did not exist. And you had asked about expectations management, correct? So how to kind of manage expectations in this patient population, again, is a little challenging. And there's a variety of reasons for that. When I talk to patients about these medications, I emphasize to them that despite what I do, they're still going to see worse. So a year or two from now, if I inject them 24 times or 12 times, you know, every other month, 2 years from now, they're going to tell me, doc, you know, my vision is worse. And I'm going to say, yes, it is worse because I'm only slowing down the inevitable. I'm certainly not stopping it. I always tell every patient that, you know, what if they choose to wait, what they lose, I cannot get back. It's usually a one-way street. So a lot of patients will say, well, I'm seeing so well, you know, can we wait? I can say yes to that. But if you wait a year and now all of a sudden, instead of 20/20, you're 20/50, I'm not going to be able to get you back to 20/20. So making that very clear off the bat, I think is absolutely critical. And so usually the analogy I use is kind of a train, you know, going 100 miles per hour. I'm slowing it down to 70 miles per hour. So we're still going to reach our destination. We're just going to reach it a little bit more slowly than we would otherwise. And so managing expectations in that regard is absolutely critical because you want patients to stick with it. You want them to be motivated. If they do it for a year and then they say, my vision's worse and they quit, you know, you've just wasted a year, right? Because a lot of the benefit requires multiple years of treatment to really get to that mid-20s, 30% that I mentioned earlier.
And so what are some factors we need to consider when it comes to choosing which patients to treat? And are there some patients who it might not be a good idea to treat?
What are the key factors to consider when assessing patients? Treatment burden, I think, is really the biggest one. Tolerance of treatment is really the biggest one. And their social network and support system. So some of the things that I talk to patients about, you know, is number one, how healthy are you? Do you have heart disease? Are you on oxygen? You know, do you have cancer, metastatic cancer? Are you able to get here every 2 months and stick with this? You know, are there other reasons why longevity may be affected? This is a medication that does require many years to see a benefit. So would I start this on a 97-year-old who is on oxygen and just had a bypass? You know, probably not, right? And so kind of taking a holistic view of the patient and their medical comorbidities is absolutely critical. Other factors to consider, is there other eye history? You know, have they had a history of retinal detachment? Have they had a history of glaucoma? These medications are fairly viscous. They do bump up the eye pressure on a injection by injection basis. And so sometimes patients who have severe glaucoma may not be the best candidates. Maybe the glaucoma is going to take their vision out before their atrophy does. So none of us have a crystal ball, obviously. And I emphasize that to patients that I can't always predict, you know, the trajectory of their disease and the speed of their disease, but doing our best to kind of make a determination onto the health of their eye and the health of them in general is a key factor in whether or not you want to start therapy of this nature. The other factor that I like to consider is social support. You know, a lot of these patients are older. Some of them live in nursing homes. Some of them, you know, rely on the availability and transport of family members. And so, you know, you go from seeing them once every 6 to 8 months to seeing them every other month, and then essentially making their vision limited for some period of time after the injection, you know, with the recovery and all of that, they're going to need assistance when they're at home. And it is not safe to do both these injections in both eyes, you know, effectively limit someone who is already limited and send them home without some kind of level of support. So that's another aspect that we have to take into consideration.
And so looking at the future, looking at research that's underway right now, what sort of things do you think that we'll be learning about the complement system inhibitors in the near future and treatment? And what new factors about the efficacy of these drugs are currently being investigated?
Yeah, so, you know, I think this has kind of been a sticking point amongst a lot of retina specialists in the community and certainly in the academic centers as well. You know, both of these drugs have essentially anatomic endpoints, right? So we are looking predominantly at the slowing of the geographic atrophy lesion. And so they were approved based off of showing a significant reduction in lesion growth over time. Now, looking at that from a visual acuity standpoint is challenging because we do know that they're just slowing things down. And so we don't really expect visual acuity to improve or not change in the ways that other trials usually focus on. Right? Wet AMD, wet macular degeneration trials looked at things like visual recovery or visual preservation, which is much harder to do in these studies that are taking place over many years, right? Most drug trials are a year or two. They're not 5 years or 10 years. So there is some limitation in functional outcomes, meaning visual acuity outcomes in these patients. Now, that being said, there's a lot of post hoc data that has been looked at in these patient populations, looking at things that we don't classically assess for in an ophthalmology clinic. We focus so much on visual acuity, right? The chart on the wall, you know, the big E and all of those things. We don't look at functional vision, which is frankly more important to patients. Their ability to read, reading speed, for example, driving ability, their levels of scotomas in their center of vision, you know, areas where they may have a blind spot. Those are not things that are classically measured by a straightforward visual acuity Snellen chart. Groups are looking a little bit more at the functional outcomes of complement inhibitor therapy, and those have shown to be beneficial. And so I think that's where the future is going to be, is kind of understanding the extent to which people's function is preserved. And I'm a believer in that. Why? Because if you're preserving structure, you are likely to be preserving function. I mean, that is the basis behind pretty much all modern medical thinking and theology, so to speak. And so if you preserve structure for long enough, function should follow.
Well, thank you so much. And that's all the time we have today. I'd like to thank Dr. Nanda for joining us to discuss geographic atrophy diagnosis and treatment and the patient-provider conversations that can help guide treatment decisions in these situations. Thanks so much for joining us today, Dr. Nanda.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
And thank you for joining us. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education and the American Nurses Credentialing Center to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with ACCME Essentials. I would like to give a special thanks to our supporters, Apellis and Astellas, who provided educational grants for this activity.